Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is episode 75, presenting chapters 6, 7, and 8 of The Gods of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. The theme of this episode very much centers on the incredible arrogance of the Therns, or White Martians, who envision themselves as being so much above the other Barsoomians that they are entitled to treat them as cattle, even to the extent of eating them. In our last episode, John Carter, Tars Tarkas, and Thuvia speculated on whether there was some further entity which would treat the white Barsoomians as the Therns treat the other races of Barsoom. And in this episode, we get the feeling that maybe there is. Another aspect of the arrogance of the Therns is their failure to realize who they had and treat him accordingly. Firstly, of course, if they have any feelings of gratitude, they owe their lives to Captain Carter unless they have some kind of private air supply. And they're supposed to know everything that goes on in the outer world, so they would have to know that Captain Carter would fight the entire horde of Warhoon with one hand tied behind his back to settle a $5 bet. He's not the sort of person you should antagonize. And he's not the sort of person you should expect to win against. Speaking of fighting, pretty early in Chapter 6, a major fight breaks out, and Captain Carter gets so caught up in observing it that he does not immediately see his opportunity for escape. As usual, he refers to his fighting Virginian ancestors, even though he has already told us that he has no memory of ever having been a child. There is a passage which reminds me of something from the 12th or 13th century Otia Imperialia of Gervasius of Tilbury. It's also enormously funny to me. We run into another mention of the extremely thin air of Mars. Given that the atmosphere is being produced in a factory, you do kind of wonder why they don't just build another 3 or 4 factories and increase the air pressure to a comfortable value. We meet someone named Zodar, that's with an X because it's cooler, which really sounds to me like some kind of Power Rangers thing. Zodar delivers what can only be described as a lecture on natural history, if that subject were usually approached with the aid of powerful hallucinogens. I mean, this is the kind of thing that makes barnacle geese sound sensible. Just in passing, he gives us the Tree of Life and the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil all in one. It's impossible to tell how much of this is actually the beliefs or knowledge of his people, and how much of it he's just making up for the benefit of our hero. We get hold of some additional technobabble in the form of carborundum aluminum. We see the inside of a lava chamber, which is interesting enough. Kind of an Arnie Sacknason moment. And we are informed of the woeful deficiencies of imagination of the learned men among the Red Martians, who, for some reason at this point, are reminding me of Professor Stahlbaug from the anime El Hazard. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. No installment of By Air Express to Venus this time. Maybe next time, we'll see. Hope you're not too badly disappointed with that. Also, I'm considering doing a new show with a different concept. Maybe Saturdays at 19 UTC for half an hour, tentatively called A Step Farther Out, which would be, instead of me reading, me talking about things that I find important. I don't know. It's a thought. Chapter 6, The Black Pirates of Barsoom. "What is it?" I asked of the girl. For answer, she pointed to the sky. I looked, and there above us I saw shadowy bodies, flitting hither and thither, high over temple, court, and garden. Almost immediately, flashes of light broke from these strange objects. There was a roar of musketry, and then answering flashes and roars from temple and rampart. "The Black Pirates of Barsoom, O Prince," said Thuvia. In great circles, the aircraft of the Marauders swept lower and lower toward the defending forces of the Thurans. Volley after volley they vomited upon the temple guards. Volley on volley crashed through the thin air toward the fleeting and elusive flyers. As the pirates swooped closer toward the ground, Thurn soldiery poured from the temples into the gardens and courts. The sight of them in the open brought a score of flyers darting toward us from all directions. The Thurns fired upon them through shields affixed to their rifles, but on, steadily on, came the grim black craft. They were small flyers for the most part, built for 2 to 3 men. A few larger ones there were, but these kept high aloft, dropping bombs upon the temples from their keel batteries. At length, with a concerted rush, evidently in response to a signal of command, the pirates in our immediate vicinity dashed recklessly to the ground in the very midst of the Thurn soldiery. Scarcely waiting for their craft to touch, the creatures manning them leapt among the Thurns with the fury of demons. Such fighting! Never had I witnessed its like before. I had thought the Green Martians the most ferocious warriors in the universe, but the awful abandon with which the black pirates threw themselves upon their foes transcended everything I ever before had seen. Beneath the brilliant light of Mars' 2 glorious moons, the whole scene presented itself in vivid distinctness. The golden-haired, white-skinned Thurns battling with desperate courage in hand-to-hand conflict with their ebony-skinned foemen. Here, a little knot of struggling warriors trampled a bed of gorgeous Pimalia. There, the curved sword of a black man found the heart of a Thurn and left its dead foeman at the foot of a wondrous statue carved from a living ruby. Yonder, a dozen Thurns pressed a single pirate back upon a bench of emerald, upon whose iridescent surface a strangely beautiful Barsoomian design was traced out in inlaid diamonds. A little to one side stood Thuvia, the Thark, and I. The tide of battle had not reached us, but the fighters from time to time swung close enough that we might distinctly note them. The black pirates interested me immensely. I had heard vague rumors, little more than legends they were, during my former life on Mars, but never had I seen them, nor talked with one who had. They were popularly supposed to inhabit the lesser moon, from which they descended upon Barsoom at long intervals. Where they visited, they wrought the most horrible atrocities, and when they left, carried away with them firearms and ammunition, and young girls as prisoners. These latter, the rumor had it, they sacrificed to some terrible god in an orgy which ended in the eating of their victims. I had an excellent opportunity to examine them, as the strife occasionally brought now one and now another close to where I stood. They were large men, possibly 6 feet and over in height. Their features were clear-cut and handsome in the extreme. Their eyes were well-set and large, though a slight narrowness lent them a crafty appearance. The iris, as well as I could determine by moonlight, was of extreme blackness, while the eyeball itself quite white and clear. The physical structure of their bodies seemed identical with those of the Thurns, the Red Man, and my own. Only in the color of their skin did they differ materially from us. That is of the appearance of polished ebony, and odd as it may seem for a southerner to say it, adds to rather than detracts from their marvelous beauty. But if their bodies are divine, their hearts apparently are quite the reverse. Never did I witness such a malign lust for blood as these demons of the outer air evinced in their mad battle with the Thurns. All about us, in the garden, lay their sinister craft, which the Thurns, for some reason then unaccountable to me, made no effort to injure. Now and again a black warrior would rush from a nearby temple, bearing a young woman in his arms. Straight for his flyer he would leap, while those of his comrades who fought nearby would rush to cover his escape. The Thurns, on their side, would hasten to rescue the girl, and in an instant the two would be swallowed in the vortex of a maelstrom of yelling devils, hacking and hewing at one another like fiends incarnate. But always, it seemed, were the black pirates of Barsoom victorious, and the girl, brought miraculously unharmed through the conflict, borne away into the outer darkness upon the deck of a swift flyer. Fighting similar to that which surrounded us could be heard in both directions as far as sound carried, and Thuvia told me that the attacks of the black pirates were usually made simultaneously along the entire ribbon-like domain of the Thurns, which circles the valley door on the outer slopes of the mountains of Utz. As the fighting receded from our position for a moment, Thuvia turned toward me with a question. "Do you understand now, O Prince," she said, "why 1,000,000 warriors guard the domains of the holy Thurns by day and by night? The scene you are witnessing now is but a repetition of what I have seen enacted a score of times during the 15 years I have been a prisoner here. From time immemorial, the black pirates of Barsoom have preyed upon the holy Thurns, yet they never carry their expeditions to a point, as one might readily believe it was in their power to do, where the extermination of the race of Thurns is threatened. It is as though they but utilize the race's playthings, with which they satisfy their ferocious lust for fighting, and from whom they collect toll in arms and ammunition and in prisoners." "Why don't they jump in and destroy these flyers?" I asked. "That would soon put a stop to the attacks, or at least the blacks would scarce be so bold. Why, see how perfectly unguarded they leave their craft, as though they were lying safe in their own hangars at home." The Therns do not dare. They tried it once, ages ago. But the next night, and for a whole moon thereafter, 1,000 great black battleships circled the mountains of Utz, pouring tons of projectiles upon the temples, the gardens, and the courts, until every Thern who was not killed was driven for safety into the subterranean galleries. The Therns know that they live at all only by the sufferance of the black men. They were near to extermination that once, and they will not venture risking it again. As she ceased talking, a new element was instilled into the conflict. It came from a source equally unlooked for by either Thern or pirate. The great Banths, which we had liberated in the garden, had evidently been awed at first by the sound of the battle, the yelling of the warriors, and the loud report of rifle and bomb. But now they must have become angered by the continuous noise and excited by the smell of new blood, for all of a sudden, a great form shot from a clump of low shrubbery into the midst of a struggling mass of humanity. A horrid scream of bestial rage broke from the Banth as he felt warm flesh beneath his powerful talons. As though his cry was but a signal to the others, the entire great pack hurled themselves among the fighters. Panic reigned in an instant. Thern and black man turned alike against the common enemy, for the Banths showed no partiality toward either. The awful beasts bore down 100 men by the mere weight of their great bodies as they hurled themselves into the thick of a fight. Leaping and clawing, they mowed down the warriors with their powerful paws, turning for an instant to rend their victims with frightful fangs. The scene was fascinating in its terribleness. But suddenly it came to me that we were wasting valuable time watching this conflict, which in itself might prove a means of our escape. The Therns were so engaged with their terrible assailants that now, if ever, escape should be comparatively easy. I turned to search for an opening through the containing hordes. If we could but reach the ramparts, we might find that the pirates somewhere had thinned the guarding forces and left a way open to us, to the world without. As my eyes wandered about the garden, the sight of hundreds of air craft lying unguarded about us suggested the simplest avenue to freedom. Why had it not occurred to me before? I was thoroughly familiar with the mechanism of every known make of flyer on Barsoom. For 9 years I had sailed and fought with the Navy of Helium. I had raced through space on the tiny one-man air scout, and I had commanded the greatest battleship that had ever floated in the thin air of dying Mars. To think, with me, is to act. Grasping Thuvia by the arm, I whispered to Tars Tarkas to follow me. Quickly we glided toward a small flyer which lay furthest from the battling warriors. Another instant found us huddled on the tiny deck. My hand was on the starting lever. I pressed my thumb upon the button which controls the ray of repulsion, the splendid discovery of the Martians, which permits them to navigate the thin atmosphere of their planet in huge ships that dwarf the dreadnoughts of our earthly navies into pitiful insignificance. The craft swayed slightly, but she did not move. Then a new cry of warning broke upon our ears. Turning, I saw a dozen black pirates dashing toward us from the melee. We had been discovered. With shrieks of rage, the demons sprang for us. With frenzied insistence, I continued to press the little button which should have sent us racing out into space, but still the vessel refused to budge. Then it came to me, the reason that she would not rise. We had stumbled upon a two-man flyer. Its ray tanks were charged only with sufficient repulsive energy to lift two ordinary men. The Thark's great weight was anchoring us to our doom. The blacks were nearly upon us. There was not an instant to be lost in hesitation or doubt. I pressed the button far in and locked it. Then I set the lever at high speed, and as the blacks came yelling upon us, I slipped from the craft's deck and with drawn longsword met the attack. At the same moment, a girl's shriek rang out behind me, and an instant later, as the blacks fell upon me, I heard far above my head and faintly in Thuvia's voice, "My prince! Oh, my prince! I would rather remain and die with—" But the rest was lost in the noise of my assailants. I knew, though, that my ruse had worked, and that temporarily, at least, Thuvia and Tars Tarkas were safe, and the means of escape was theirs. For a moment it seemed that I could not withstand the weight of numbers that confronted me, but again, as on so many other occasions, when I had been called upon to face fearful odds upon this planet of warriors and fierce beasts, I found that my earthly strength so far transcended that of my opponents, that the odds were not so greatly against me as they appeared. My seething blade wove a net of death about me. For an instant the blacks pressed close to reach me with their shorter swords, but presently they gave back, and the esteem in which they suddenly had learned to hold my sword arm was writ large upon each countenance. I knew, though, that it was but a question of minutes before their greater numbers would wear me down or get around my guard. I must go down eventually to certain death before them. I shuddered at the thought of it, dying thus in this terrible place where no word of my end ever could reach my Deja Thoris, dying at the hands of nameless black men in the gardens of the cruel Therns. Then my old-time spirit reasserted itself. The fighting blood of my Virginian sires coursed hot through my veins. The fierce bloodlust and the joy of battle surged over me. The fighting smile that has brought consternation to 1,000 foemen touched my lips. I put the thought of death out of my mind, and fell upon my antagonists with fury that those who escaped will remember to their dying day. That others would press to the support of those who faced me I knew, so even as I fought I kept my wits at work, searching for an avenue of escape. It came from an unexpected quarter out of the black night behind me. I had just disarmed a huge fellow who had given me a desperate struggle, and for a moment the blacks stood back for a breathing spell. They eyed me with malignant fury, yet withal there was a touch of respect in their demeanor. "Thern," said one, "you fight like a debtor. But for your detestable yellow hair and your white skin, you would be an honor to the firstborn of Barsoom." "I am no Thern," I said, and I was about to explain that I was from another world, thinking that by patching a truce with these fellows and fighting with them against the Therns, I might enlist their aid in regaining my liberty. But just at that moment, a heavy object smote me a resounding whack between my shoulders that nearly felled me to the ground. As I turned to meet this new enemy, an object passed over my shoulder, striking one of my assailants squarely in the face and knocking him senseless to the sward. At the same instant, I saw that the thing that had struck us was the trailing anchor of a rather fair-sized air vessel, possibly a 10-man cruiser. The ship was floating slowly above us, not more than 50 feet over our heads. Instantly, the one chance for escape that it offered presented itself to me. The vessel was slowly rising, and now the anchor was beyond the blacks who faced me and several feet above their heads. With a bound that left them gaping in wide-eyed astonishment, I sprang completely over them. A second leap carried me just high enough to grasp the now rapidly receding anchor. But I was successful, and there I hung by one hand, dragging through the branches of the higher vegetation of the gardens, while my late foeman shrieked and howled beneath me. Presently, the vessel veered toward the west, and then swung gracefully to the south. In another instant, I was carried beyond the crest of the Golden Cliffs, out over the Valley Dor, where, 6,000 feet below me, the lost Sea of Chorus lay shimmering in the moonlight. Carefully, I climbed to a sitting posture across the anchor's arms. I wondered if, by chance, the vessel might be deserted. I hoped so, or possibly it might belong to a friendly people and have wandered by accident almost within the clutches of the pirates and the Therns. The fact that it was retreating from the scene of battle lent color to this hypothesis. But I decided to know positively, and at once. So, with the greatest caution, I commenced to climb slowly up the anchor chain toward the deck above me. One hand had just reached for the vessel's rail and found it, when a fierce black face was thrust over the side, and eyes filled with triumphant hate looked into mine. Chapter 7. A Fair Goddess. For an instant, the black pirate and I remained motionless, glaring into each other's eyes. Then a grim smile curled the handsome lips above me, as an ebony hand came slowly in sight from above the edge of the deck, and the cold hollow eye of a revolver sought out the center of my forehead. Simultaneously, my free hand shot out for the black throat, just within reach, and the ebony finger tightened on the trigger. The pirate's hissing, "Die, cursed Thern!" was half-choked in his windpipe by my clutching fingers. The hammer fell with a futile click upon an empty chamber. Before he could fire again, I had pulled him so far over the edge of the deck that he was forced to drop the firearm and clutch the rail with both hands. My grasp upon his throat effectually prevented any outcry, and so we struggled in grim silence, he to tear away from my hold, I to drag him over to his death. His face was taking on a livid hue, his eyes were bulging from their sockets. It was evident to him that he soon must die unless he tore loose from the steel fingers that were choking the life from him. With a final effort, he threw himself further back upon the deck, at the same instant releasing his hold upon the rail to tear frantically with both hands at my fingers in an effort to drag them from his throat. That little second was all that I awaited. With one mighty downward surge, I swept him clear of the deck. His falling body came near to tearing me from the frail hold that my single free hand had upon the anchor chain, and plunging me with him to the waters of the sea below. I did not relinquish my grasp upon him, however, for I knew that a single shriek from those lips as he hurtled to his death in the silent waters of the sea would bring his comrades from above to avenge him. Instead, I held grimly to him, choking, ever choking, while his frantic struggles dragged me lower and lower toward the end of the chain. Gradually his contortions became spasmodic, lessening by degrees until they ceased entirely. Then I released my hold upon him, and in an instant he was swallowed by the black shadows far below. Again I climbed to the ship's rail. This time I succeeded in raising my eyes to the level of the deck, where I could take a careful survey of the conditions immediately confronting me. The nearer moon had passed below the horizon, but the clear effulgence of the further satellite bathed the deck of the cruiser, bringing into sharp relief the bodies of 6 or 8 black men sprawled about in sleep. Huddled close to the base of a rapid-fire gun was a young white girl, securely bound. Her eyes were widespread in an expression of horrified anticipation and fixed directly upon me as I came in sight above the edge of the deck. Unutterable relief instantly filled them as they fell upon the mystic jewel which sparkled in the center of my stolen headpiece. She did not speak. Instead, her eyes warned me to beware the sleeping figures that surrounded her. Noiselessly, I gained the deck. The girl nodded to me to approach her. As I bent low, she whispered to me to release her. "I can aid you," she said, "and you will need all aid available when they awaken." Some of them will awaken Chorus, I replied, smiling. She caught the meaning of my words, and the cruelty of her answering smile horrified me. One is not astonished by cruelty in a hideous face, but when it touches the features of a goddess, whose fine chiseled lineaments might more fittingly portray love and beauty, the contrast is appalling. Quickly I released her. Give me a revolver, she whispered. I can use that upon those your sword does not silence in time. I did as she bid. Then I turned toward the distasteful work that lay before me. This was no time for fine compunctions, nor for a chivalry that these cruel demons would neither appreciate nor reciprocate. Stealthily, I approached the nearest sleeper. When he awoke, he was well on his journey to the bosom of Chorus. His piercing shriek as consciousness returned to him came faintly up to us from the black depths beneath. The second awoke as I touched him, and though I succeeded in hurling him from the cruiser's deck, his wild cry of alarm brought the remaining pirates to their feet. There were five of them. As they arose, the girl's revolver spoke in sharp staccato, and one sank back to the deck again to rise no more. The others rushed madly upon me with drawn swords. The girl evidently dared not fire for fear of wounding me, but I saw her sneak stealthily and cat-like toward the flank of the attackers. Then they were on me. For a few minutes I experienced some of the hottest fighting I had ever passed through. The quarters were too small for footwork. It was stand your ground and give and take. At first, I took considerably more than I gave, but presently I got beneath one fellow's guard and had the satisfaction of seeing him collapse upon the deck. The others redoubled their efforts. The crashing of their blades upon mine raised a terrific din that might have been heard for miles through the silent night. Sparks flew as steel smote steel, and then there was the dull and sickening sound of a shoulder bone parting beneath the keen edge of my Martian sword. Three now faced me, but the girl was working her way to a point that would soon permit her to reduce the number by one at least. Then, things happened with such amazing rapidity that I can scarce comprehend even now all that took place in that brief instant. The three rushed me, with the evident purpose of forcing me back the few steps that would carry my body over the rail into the void below. At the same instant, the girl fired, and my sword arm made two moves. One man dropped with a bullet in his brain. A sword flew clattering across the deck and dropped over the edge beyond as I disarmed one of my opponents, and the third went down with my blade buried to the hilt in his breast and 3 feet of it protruding from his back, and falling, wrenched the sword from my grasp. Disarmed myself, I now faced my remaining foeman, whose own sword lay somewhere thousands of feet below us, lost in the lost sea. The new conditions seemed to please my adversary, for a smile of satisfaction bared his gleaming teeth as he rushed at me barehanded. The great muscles which rolled beneath his glossy black hide evidently assured him that here was easy prey, not worth the trouble of drawing the dagger from his harness. I let him come almost upon me. Then I ducked beneath his outstretched arms, at the same time sidestepping to the right. Pivoting on my left toe, I swung a terrific right to his jaw, and like a felled ox, he dropped in his tracks. A low, silvery laugh rang out behind me. "You are no Thurn," said the sweet voice of my companion. "For all your golden locks or the harness of Sator Throg, never lived there upon all Barsoom before one who could fight as you have fought this night. Who are you?" "I am John Carter, Prince of the House of Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium," I replied. "And whom," I added, "has the honor of serving been accorded me?" She hesitated a moment before speaking. Then she asked, "You are no Thurn. Are you an enemy of the Thurns?" "I have been in the territory of the Thurns for a day and a half. During the entire time, my life has been in constant danger. I have been harassed and persecuted. Armed men and fierce beasts have been set upon me. I had no quarrel with the Thurns before, but can you wonder that I feel no great love for them now? I have spoken." She looked at me intently for several minutes before she replied. It was as though she were attempting to read my inmost soul, to judge my character and my standards of chivalry in that long-drawn searching gaze. Apparently, the inventory satisfied her. "I am Fydor, daughter of Mattai Shang, Holy Hecador of the Holy Thurns, Father of Thurns, Master of Life and Death upon Barsoom, Brother of Issus, Prince of Life Eternal." At that moment, I noticed that the black I had dropped with my fist was commencing to show signs of returning consciousness. I sprang to his side. Stripping his harness from him, I securely bound his hands behind his back, and after similarly fastening his feet, tied him to a heavy gun carriage. "Why not the simpler way?" asked Fydor. "I do not understand. What simpler way?" I replied. With a slight shrug of her lovely shoulders, she made a gesture with her hands personating the casting of something over the craft's side. "I am no murderer," I said. "I kill in self-defense only." She looked at me narrowly, then she puckered those divine brows of hers and shook her head. She could not comprehend. Well, neither had my own Deja Thoris been able to understand what to her had seemed a foolish and dangerous policy toward enemies. Upon Barsoom, quarter is neither asked nor given, and each dead man means so much more of the waning resources of this dying planet to be divided amongst those who survive. But there seemed a subtle difference here between the manner in which the girl contemplated the dispatching of an enemy and the tender-hearted regret of my own princess for the stern necessity which demanded it. I think that Fydor regretted the thrill that the spectacle would have afforded her, rather than the fact that my decision left another enemy alive to threaten us. The man had now regained full possession of his faculties, and was regarding us intently from where he lay bound upon the deck. He was a handsome fellow, clean-limbed and powerful, with an intelligent face and features of such exquisite chiseling that Adonis himself might have envied him. The vessel, unguided, had been moving slowly across the valley, but now I thought it time to take the helm and direct her course. Only in a very general way could I guess the location of the valley door. That it was far south of the equator was evident from the constellations, but I was not sufficient a Martian astronomer to come much closer than a rough guess without the splendid charts and delicate instruments with which, as an officer in the Heliumite Navy, I had formally reckoned the positions of the vessels on which I sailed. That a northerly course would quickest lead me toward the more settled portions of the planet immediately decided the direction that I should steer. Beneath my hand, the cruiser swung gracefully about, then the button which controlled the repulsive rays sent us soaring far out into space. With speed lever pulled to the last notch, we raced toward the north as we rose ever farther and farther above that terrible Valley of Death. As we passed at a dizzy height over the narrow domains of the Therns, the flash of powder far below bore mute witness to the ferocity of the battle that still raged along that krill frontier. No sound of conflict reached our ears, for in the rarefied atmosphere of our great altitude no sound wave could penetrate. They were dissipated in thin air far below us. It became intensely cold. Breathing was difficult. The girl, Fydor, and the Black Pirate kept their eyes glued upon me. At length, the girl spoke. "Unconsciousness comes quickly at this altitude," she said quietly. "Unless you are inviting death for us all, you had best drop, and that quickly." There was no fear in her voice. It was as one might say, "You had better carry an umbrella, it is going to rain." I dropped the vessel quickly to a lower level, nor was I a moment too soon. The girl has swooned. The Black, too, was unconscious. While I myself retained my senses, I think only by sheer will, the one on whom all responsibility rests is apt to endure the most. We were swinging low above the foothills of the Orts. It was comparatively warm, and there was plenty of air for our starved lungs, so I was not surprised to see the Black open his eyes, and a moment later the girl also. "It was a close call," she said. "It has taught me two things, though," I replied. "What?" "That even Fydor, daughter of the Master of Life and Death, is mortal," I said, smiling.
"There is immortality only in Issus," she replied, "and Issus is for the race of Therns alone. Thus am I immortal."
I caught a fleeting grin passing across the features of the Black as he heard her words. I did not then understand why he smiled. Later I was to learn, and she too, in a most horrible manner.
"If the other thing you have just learned," she continued, "has led to as erroneous deductions as the first, you are little richer in knowledge than you were before."
"The other," I replied, "is that our dusky friend here does not hail from the nearer moon. He was like to have died at a few thousand feet above Barsoom. Had we continued the 5,000 miles that lie between Thuria and the planet, he would have been but the frozen memory of a man." Fydor looked at the Black in evident astonishment.
"If you are not of Thuria, then where?" she asked.
He shrugged his shoulders and turned his eyes elsewhere, but did not reply. The girl stamped her little foot in a peremptory manner.
"The daughter of Metai Shang is not accustomed to having her queries remain unanswered," she said. "One of the lesser breed should feel honored that a member of the holy race that was born to inherit life eternal should deign even to notice him."
Again the Black smiled that wicked, knowing smile.
"Zodar, Dator of the firstborn of Barsoom, is accustomed to give commands, not to receive them," replied the Black Pirate.
Then, turning to me,
"What are your intentions concerning me?"
"I intend taking you both back to Helium," I said. "No harm will come to you. You will find the Red Men of Helium a kindly and magnanimous race, but if they listen to me, there will be no more voluntary pilgrimages down the River Iss, and the impossible belief that they have cherished for ages will be shattered into 1,000 pieces.
"Are you of Helium?"
he asked. "I am a prince of the House of Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium," I replied. "But I am not of Barsoom. I am of another world." Zodar looked at me intently for a few moments.
"I can well believe that you are not of Barsoom," he said at length. "None of this world could have bested 8 of the firstborn single-handed. But how is it that you wear the golden hair and the jeweled circlet of a holy Thern?"
He emphasized the word holy with a touch of irony.
"I had forgotten them," I said. "They are the spoils of conquest," and with a sweep of my hand I removed the disguise from my head.
When the Black's eyes fell on my close-cropped black hair, they opened in astonishment. Evidently, he had looked for the bald pate of a Thern.
"You are indeed of another world," he said, a touch of awe in his voice. "With the skin of a Thern, the black hair of a firstborn, and the muscles of 12 Dators, it was no disgrace even for Zodar to acknowledge your supremacy, a thing he could never do were you a Barsoomian," he added.
"You are traveling several laps ahead of me, my friend," I interrupted. "I glean that your name is Zodar. But whom, pray, are the firstborn? And what a Dator? And why, if you were conquered by a Barsoomian, could you not acknowledge it?"
The firstborn, Barsoom, he explained, are the race of black men of which I am a dator, or, as the lesser Barsoomians would say, prince. My race is the oldest on the planet. We trace our lineage unbroken direct to the Tree of Life, which flourished in the center of the Valador 23 million years ago. For countless ages, the fruit of this tree underwent the gradual changes of evolution, passing by degrees from true plant life to a combination of plant and animal. In the first stages, the fruit of the tree possessed only the power of independent muscular action, while the stem remained attached to the parent plant. Later, a brain developed in the fruit, so that hanging there by their long stems, they thought and moved as individuals. Then, with the development of perceptions, came a comparison of them. Judgments were reached and compared, and thus reason, and the power to reason, were born upon Barsoom. Ages passed. Many forms of life came and went upon the Tree of Life, but still all were attached to the parent plant by stems of varying lengths. At length, the fruit tree consisted in tiny plant men, such as we now see reproduced in such huge dimensions in the Valador, but still hanging to the limbs and branches of the tree by the stems which grew from the tops of their heads. The buds, from which the plant men blossomed, resembled large nuts about a foot in diameter, divided by double partition walls into four sections. In one section grew the plant man, in another, a 16-legged worm, in the third, the progenitor of the white ape, and in the fourth, the primeval black man of Barsoom. When the bud burst, the plant man remained dangling at the end of his stem, but the three other sections fell to the ground, where the efforts of their imprisoned occupants to escape sent them hopping about in all directions. Thus, as time went on, all Barsoom was covered with these imprisoned creatures. For countless ages, they lived their long lives within their hard shells, hopping and skipping about the broad planet, falling into rivers, lakes, and seas to be still further spread about the surface of the new world. Countless billions died before the first black man broke through his prison walls into the light of day. Prompted by curiosity, he broke open other shells, and the peopling of Barsoom commenced. The pure strain of the blood of this first black man has remained untainted by admixture with other creatures, in the race of which I am a member. But from the 16-legged worm, the first ape, and renegade black man, has sprung every other form of animal life upon Barsoom. The Therns, and he smiled maliciously as he spoke, are but the result of ages of evolution from the pure white ape of antiquity. They are a lower order still. There is but one race of true and immortal humans on Barsoom. It is the race of black men. The Tree of Life is dead, but before it died, the plant men learned to detach themselves from it and roam the face of Barsoom with the other children of the first parent. Now, their bisexuality permits them to reproduce themselves after the manner of true plants, but otherwise they have progressed but little in all the ages of their existence. Their actions and movements are largely matters of instinct, and not guided to any great extent by reason, since the brain of a plant man is but trifle larger than the end of your smallest finger. They live upon vegetation and the blood of animals, and their brain is just large enough to direct their movements in the direction of food, and to translate the food sensations, which are carried to it from their eyes and ears. They have no sense of self-preservation, and so are entirely without fear in the face of danger. That is why they are such terrible antagonists in combat. I wondered why the black man took such pains to discourse thus at length to enemies upon the genesis of life Barsoomian. It seemed a strangely inopportune moment for a proud member of a proud race to unbend in casual conversation with a captor, especially in view of the fact that the black still lay securely bound upon the deck. It was the faintest straying of his eye beyond me for the barest fraction of a second that explained his motive for thus dragging out my interest in his truly absorbing story. He lay a little forward of where I stood at the levers, and thus he faced the stern of the vessel as he addressed me. It was at the end of his description of the plant man that I caught his eye fixed momentarily upon something behind me. Nor could I be mistaken in the swift gleam of triumph that brightened those dark orbs for an instant. Some time before, I had reduced our speed, for we had left the Valador many miles astern, and I felt comparatively safe. I turned an apprehensive glance behind me, and the sight that I saw froze the newborn hope of freedom that had been springing up within me. A great battleship, forging silent and unlighted through the dark night, loomed close astern. Chapter 8. The Depths of Omeyan. Now I realized why the black pirate had kept me engrossed with his strange tale. For miles he had sensed the approach of succor,
and but for that single telltale glance, the battleship would have been directly above us in another moment, and the boarding party, which was doubtless even now swinging in their harness from the ship's keel, would have swarmed our deck, placing my rising hope of escape in sudden and total eclipse. I was too old a hand in aerial warfare to be at a loss now for the right maneuver. Simultaneously, I reversed the engines and dropped the little vessel a sheer 100 feet. Above my head, I could see the dangling forms of the boarding party as the battleship raced over us. Then I rose at a sharp angle, throwing my speed lever to its last notch. Like a bolt from a crossbow, my splendid craft shot its steel prow straight at the whirring propellers of the giant above us. If I could but touch them, the huge bulk would be disabled for hours and escape once more possible. At the same instant, the sun shot over the horizon, disclosing 100 grim black faces peering over the stern of the battleship upon us. At sight of us, a shout of rage went up from 100 throats. Orders were shouted, but it was too late to save the giant propellers, and with a crash we rammed them! Instantly, with the shock of impact, I reversed my engine, but my prow was wedged in the hole it had made in the battleship's stern. Only a second I hung there before tearing away, but that second was amply long to swarm my deck with black devils. There was no fight. In the first place, there was no room to fight. We were simply submerged by numbers. Then, as swords menaced me, a command from Zodar stayed the hands of his fellows.
"Secure them," he said, "but do not injure them."
Several of the pirates already had released Zodar. He now personally attended to my disarming, and saw that I was properly bound. At least, he thought that the binding was secure. It would have been, had I been a Martian, but I had to smile at the puny strands that confined my wrists. When the time came, I could snap them as they had been cotton string. The girl they bound also, and then they fastened us together. In the meantime, they had brought our craft alongside the disabled battleship, and soon we were transported to the latter's deck. Fully 1,000 black men manned the great engine of destruction. Her decks were crowded with them, as they pressed forward as far as discipline would permit to get a glimpse of their captives. The girl's beauty elicited many brutal comments and vulgar jests. It was evident that these self-thought supermen were far inferior to the red men of Barsoom in refinement and in chivalry. My close-cropped black hair and thern complexion were the subjects of much comment. When Zodar told his fellow nobles of my fighting ability and strange origin, they crowded about me with numerous questions. The fact that I wore the harness and metal of a thern who had been killed by a member of my party convinced them that I was an enemy of their hereditary foes and placed me on a better footing in their estimation. Without exception, the blacks were handsome men and well-built. The officers were conspicuous through the wondrous magnificence of their resplendent trappings. Many harnesses were so encrusted with gold, platinum, silver, and precious stones as to entirely hide the leather beneath. The harness of the commanding officer was a solid mass of diamonds. Against the ebony background of his skin, they blazed out with a peculiarly accentuated effulgence. The whole scene was enchanting. The handsome men, the barbaric splendor of the accoutrements, the polished skeel wood of the deck, the gloriously grained serapis of the cabins, inlaid with priceless jewels and precious metals in intricate and beautiful design, the burnished gold of handrails, the shining metal of the guns. Fyodor and I were taken below decks, where, still fast bound, we were thrown into a small compartment which contained a single porthole. As our escort left us, they barred the door behind them. We could hear the men working on the broken propellers, and from the porthole we could see that the vessel was drifting lazily toward the south. For some time, neither of us spoke. Each was occupied with his own thoughts. For my part, I was wondering as to the fate of Tars Tarkas and the girl Thuvia. Even if they succeeded in eluding pursuit, they must eventually fall into the hands of either red men or green, and as fugitives from the valley door, they could look for but little else than a swift and terrible death. How I wished that I might have accompanied them! It seemed to me that I could not fail to impress upon the intelligent red men of Barsoom the wicked deception that a cruel and senseless superstition had foisted upon them. Tardos Mors would believe me. Of that I was positive, and that he would have the courage of his convictions, my knowledge of his character assured me. Deja Thoris would believe me. Not a doubt as to that entered my head. Then there were 1,000 of my red and green warrior friends whom I knew would face eternal damnation gladly for my sake. Like Tars Tarkas, where I led, they would follow. My only danger lay in that, should I ever escape the black pirates, it might be to fall into the hands of unfriendly red or green men. Then it would mean short shrift for me. Well, there seemed little to worry about on that score, for the likelihood of my ever escaping the blacks was extremely remote. The girl and I were linked together by a rope which permitted us to move only about 3 or 4 feet from each other. When we had entered the compartment, we had seated ourselves upon a low bench beneath the porthole.
The bench was the only furniture in the room. It was of Serapis wood. The floor, ceiling, and walls were of carborundum aluminum, a light, impenetrable composition extensively utilized in the construction of Martian fighting ships. As I had sat meditating upon the future, my eyes had been riveted upon the porthole, which was just level with them as I sat. Suddenly, I looked toward Fydor. She was regarding me with a strange expression I had not before seen upon her face. She was very beautiful then. Instantly, her white lids veiled her eyes, and I thought I discovered a delicate flush tinging her cheek. Evidently, she was embarrassed at having been detected in the act of staring at a lesser creature, I thought. "Do you find the study of the lower orders interesting?" I asked, laughing. She looked up again with a nervous but relieved little laugh. "Oh, very," she said, "especially when they have such excellent profiles." It was my turn to flush, but I did not. I felt that she was poking fun at me, and I admired a brave heart that could look for humor on the road to death, and so I laughed with her. "Do you know where we are going?" she said. "To solve the mystery of the eternal hereafter, I imagine," I replied. "I am going to a worse fate than that," she said, with a little shudder. "What do you mean?" "I can only guess," she replied, "since no Thern damsel of all the millions that have been stolen away by black pirates during the ages they have raided our domains has ever been returned to narrate her experiences among them. That they never take a man prisoner lends strength to the belief that the fate of the girls they steal is worse than death."
"Is it not a just retribution?" I could not help but ask.
"What do you mean?"
"Do not the Therns themselves do likewise with the poor creatures who take the voluntary pilgrimage down the River of Mystery? Was not Thuvia for 15 years a plaything and a slave? Is it less than just that you should suffer as you have caused others to suffer?"
"You do not understand," she replied. "We Therns are a holy race. It is an honor to a lesser creature to be a slave among us. Did we not occasionally save a few of the lower orders that stupidly float down an unknown river to an unknown end? All would become the prey of the plant men and the apes."
"But do you not by every means encourage the superstition among those of the outside world?" I argued. "That is the wickedest of your deeds. Can you tell me why you foster the cruel deception?"
"All life on Barsoom," she said, "is created solely for the support of the race of Therns. How else could we live, did the outer world not furnish our labor and our food? Think you that a Thern would demean himself by labor?"
"It is true, then, that you eat human flesh?" I asked in horror. She looked at me in pitying commiseration for my ignorance.
"Truly, we eat the flesh of the lower orders. Do you not also?"
"The flesh of beasts, yes," I replied, "but not the flesh of men."
"As man may eat of the flesh of beasts, so may the gods eat of the flesh of man. The holy Therns are the gods of Barsoom."
I was disgusted, and I imagine that I showed it.
"You are an unbeliever now," she continued gently, "but should we be fortunate enough to escape the clutches of the black pirates and come again to the court of Mattai Shang, I think that we shall find an argument to convince you of the error of your ways, and," she hesitated, "perhaps we shall find a way to keep you as one of us."
Again her eyes dropped to the floor, and a faint color suffused her cheek. I could not understand her meaning, nor did I, for a long time. Dejah Thoris was wont to say that in some things I was a veritable simpleton, and I guess that she was right. "I fear that I would ill requite your father's hospitality," I answered, "since the first thing that I should do, were I a Thern, would be to set an armed guard at the mouth of the River Ist to escort the poor deluded voyagers back to the outer world. Also, I should devote my life to the extermination of the hideous plant men and their horrible companions, the great white apes." She looked at me, really horror-struck.
"No, no," she cried. "You must not say such terribly sacrilegious things. You must not even think them. Should they ever guess that you entertain such frightful thoughts, should we chance to regain the temples of the Therns, they would mete out a frightful death to you. Not even my...
Again she flushed and started over.
"Not even I could save you."
I said no more. Evidently, it was useless. She was even more steeped in superstition than the Martians of the outer world. They only worshipped a beautiful hope for a life of love and peace and happiness in the hereafter. The Therns worship the hideous plant men and the apes, or at least they reverence them as the abodes of the departed spirits of their own dead. At this point, the door of our prison opened to admit Zodar. He smiled pleasantly at me, and when he smiled his expression was kindly, anything but cruel or vindictive.
"Since you cannot escape under any circumstances," he said, "I cannot see the necessity for keeping you confined below. I will cut your bonds, and you may come on deck. You will witness something very interesting, and as you never shall return to the outer world, it will do no harm to permit you to see it. You will see what no other than the firstborn and their slaves know the existence of, the subterranean entrance to the Holy Land, to the real heaven of Barsoom. It will be an excellent lesson for the daughter of the Therns," he added, "for she shall see the temple of Issus, and Issus perchance shall embrace her."
Fydor's head went high.
"What blasphemy is this, dog of a pirate?" she cried. "Issus would wipe out your entire breed, an you ever came within sight of her temple."
"You have much to learn, Thurn," replied Zodar with an ugly smile. "Nor do I envy you the manner in which you will learn it."
As we came on deck, I saw to my surprise that the vessel was passing over a great field of snow and ice, as far as the eye could reach in any direction. Naught else was visible. There could be but one solution to the mystery. We were above the South Polar ice cap. Only at the poles of Mars is there ice or snow upon the planet. No sign of life appeared below us. Evidently, we were too far south even for the great fur-bearing animals, which the Martians so delight in hunting. Zodar was at my side as I stood, looking out over the ship's rail. "What course?" I asked him.
"A little west of south," he replied. "You will see the Oats Valley directly. We shall skirt it for a few hundred miles."
"The Oats Valley!" I exclaimed. "But man, is not there where lie the domain of the Therns from which I but just escaped?"
"Yes," answered Zodar. "You crossed this ice field last night in the long chase that you led us. The Oats Valley lies in a mighty depression at the South Pole. It is sunk thousands of feet below the level of the surrounding country, like a great round bowl. 100 miles from its northern boundary rise the Oats Mountains, which circle the inner valley of Dor, in the exact center of which lies the lost Sea of Chorus. On the shore of this sea stands the golden temple of Issus in the land of the Firstborn. It is there that we are bound."
As I looked, I commenced to realize why it was that in all the ages only one had escaped from the Valley Dor. My only wonder was that even the one had been successful. To cross this frozen, wind-swept waste of bleak ice, alone and on foot, would be impossible. "Only by airboat could the journey be made," I finished aloud.
"It was thus that one did escape the Therns in bygone times, but none has ever escaped the Firstborn," said Zodar, with a touch of pride in his voice.
We had now reached the southernmost extremity of the great ice barrier. It ended abruptly in a sheer wall, thousands of feet high, at the base of which stretched a level valley, broken here and there by low rolling hills and little clumps of forest, and with tiny rivers formed by the melting of the ice barrier at its base. Once we passed far above what seemed to be a deep canyon-like rift, stretching from the ice wall on the north across the valley as far as the eye could reach.
"That is the bed of the river Iss," said Zodar. "It runs far beneath the ice field, and below the level of the Valley Oats, but its canyon is open here."
Presently I descried what I took to be a village, and pointing it out to Zodar, asked him what it might be.
"It is a village of lost souls," he answered, laughing. "The strip between the ice barrier and the mountains is considered neutral ground. Some turn off from their voluntary pilgrimage down the Iss, and, scaling the awful walls of its canyon below us, stop in the valley. Also a slave now and then escapes from the Therns and makes his way hither. They do not attempt to recapture such, since there is no escape from this outer valley, and as a matter of fact they fear the patrolling cruisers of the Firstborn too much to venture from their own domains. The poor creatures of this outer valley are not molested by us, since they have nothing that we desire, nor are they numerically strong enough to give us an interesting fight, so we too leave them alone. There are several villages of them, but they have increased in numbers but little in many years, since they are always warring among themselves."
Now we swung a little north of west, leaving the Valley of Lost Souls, and shortly I discerned over our starboard bow what appeared to be a black mountain rising from the desolate waste of ice. It was not high, and seemed to have a flat top. Zodar had left us to attend to some duty on the vessel, and Fyodor and I stood alone beside the rail. The girl had not spoken since we had been brought to the deck. "Is what he has been telling me true?" I asked her.
"In part, yes," she answered. "That about the outer valley is true, but what he says of the location of the Temple of Issus in the center of his country is false. If it is not false..."
She hesitated.
"Oh, it cannot be true. It cannot be true. For if it were true, then for countless ages have my people gone to torture and ignominious death at the hands of their cruel enemies, instead of to the beautiful life eternal that we have been taught to believe Issus holds for us."
"As the lesser Barsoomians of the outer world have been lured by you to the terrible Valley Dor, so may it be that the Therns themselves have been lured by the Firstborn to an equally horrid fate," I suggested. "It would be a stern and awful retribution, Fyodor, but a just one."
"I cannot believe it," she said.
"We shall see," I answered, and then we fell silent again, for we were rapidly approaching the Black Mountains, which in some indefinable way seemed linked with the answer to our problem. As we neared the dark truncated cone, the vessel's speed was diminished until we barely moved. Then we topped the crest of the mountain, and below us I saw yawning the mouth of a huge circular well, the bottom of which was lost in inky blackness. The diameter of this enormous pit was fully 1,000 feet. The walls were smooth, and appeared to be composed of black basaltic rock. For a moment, the vessel hovered motionless directly above the center of the gaping void, then slowly she began to settle into the black chasm.
Lower and lower she sank, until, as darkness enveloped us, her lights were thrown on, and in the dim halo of her own radiance, the monster battleship dropped on and on, down into what seemed to me must be the very bowels of Barsoom. For quite half an hour we descended, and then the shaft terminated abruptly in the dome of a mighty subterranean world. Below us rose and fell the billows of a buried sea. A phosphorescent radiance illuminated the scene. Thousands of ships dotted the bosom of the ocean. Little islands rose here and there to support the strange and colorless vegetation of this strange world. Slowly, and with majestic grace, the battleship dropped until she rested on the water. Her great propellers had been drawn and housed during our descent of the shaft, and in their place had been run out the smaller but more powerful water propellers. As these commenced to revolve, the ship took up its journey once more, riding the new element as buoyantly and as safely as she had the air. Fyodor and I were dumbfounded. Neither had either heard or dreamed that such a world existed beneath the surface of Barsoom. Nearly all the vessels we saw were war craft. There were a few lighters and barges, but none of the great merchantmen, such as ply the upper air between the cities of the outer world.
"Here is the harbor of the Navy of the Firstborn,"
said a voice behind us, and turning we saw Zodar, watching us with an amused smile on his lips.
"This sea," he continued, "is larger than Chorus. It receives the waters of the Lesser Sea above it. To keep it from filling above a certain level, we have four great pumping stations that force the oversupply back into the reservoirs far north from which the red men draw the water which irrigates their farmlands."
A new light burst on me with this explanation. The red men had always considered it a miracle that caused great columns of water to spurt from the solid rock of their reservoir sides to increase the supply of the precious liquid which is so scarce in the outer world of Mars. Never had their learned men been able to fathom the secret of the source of this enormous volume of water. As ages passed, they had simply come to accept it as a matter of course and ceased to question its origin. We passed several islands on which were strangely shaped circular buildings, apparently roofless, and pierced midway between the ground and their tops with small, heavily barred windows. They bore the earmarks of prisons, which were further accentuated by the armed guards who squatted on low benches without or patrolled the short beach lines. Few of these islets contained over an acre of ground, but presently we sighted a much larger one directly ahead. This proved to be our destination, and the great ship was soon made fast against the steep shore. Zodar signaled us to follow him, and, with a half-dozen officers and men, we left the battleship and approached a large oval structure, a couple of hundred yards from the shore.
"You shall soon see Issus," said Zodar to Fyodor. "The few prisoners we take are presented to her. Occasionally she selects slaves from among them to replenish the ranks of her handmaidens. None serves Issus above a single year," and there was a grim smile on the black's lips that lent a cruel and sinister meaning to his simple statement.
Fyodor, though loath to believe that Issus was allied to such as these, had commenced to entertain doubts and fears. She clung very closely to me, no longer the proud daughter of the master of life and death upon Barsoom, but a young and frightened girl in the power of relentless enemies. The building which we now entered was entirely roofless. In its center was a long tank of water, set below the level of the floor like the swimming pool of a natatorium. Near one side of the pool floated an odd-looking black object. Whether it were some strange monster of these buried waters, or a queer raft, I could not at once perceive. We were soon to know, however, for as we reached the edge of the pool directly above the thing, Zodar cried out a few words in a strange tongue. Immediately, a hatch cover was raised from the surface of the object, and a black seaman sprang from the bowels of the strange craft. Zodar addressed the seaman.
"Transmit to your officer," he said, "the commands of Dator Zodar. Say to him that Dator Zodar, with officers and men escorting two prisoners, would be transported to the Guardians of Issus beside the Golden Temple."
"Blessed be the shell of thy first ancestor, most noble Dator," replied the man. "It shall be done even as thou sayest."
And raising both hands, palms backward above his head after the manner of salute which is common to all races of Barsoom, he disappeared once more into the entrails of his ship. A moment later, an officer resplendent in the gorgeous trappings of his rank appeared on deck and welcomed Zodar to the vessel, and in the latter's wake we filed aboard and below. The cabin in which we found ourselves extended entirely across the ship, having portholes on either side below the waterline. No sooner were all below than a number of commands were given, in accordance with which the hatch was closed and secured, and the vessel commenced to vibrate to the rhythmic purr of its machinery.
"Where can we be going in such a tiny pool of water?"
asked Fyodor. "Not up," I replied, "for I noticed particularly that while the building is roofless, it is covered with a strong metal grating."
"Then where?"
she asked again. "From the appearance of the craft, I judge we are going down," I replied. Fyodor shuddered. For such long ages have the waters of Barsoom's seas been a thing of tradition only, that even this daughter of the Therns, born as she had been within sight of Mars' only remaining sea, had the same terror of deep water as is a common attribute of all Martians. Presently, the sensation of sinking became very apparent. We were going down swiftly. Now we could hear the water rushing past the portholes, and in the dim light that filtered through them to the water beyond, the swirling eddies were plainly visible. Fidor grasped my arm.
"Save me," she whispered. "Save me, and your every wish shall be granted. Anything within the power of the Holy Therns to give will be yours. Fidor."
She stumbled a little here, and then in a very low voice,
"Fidor already is yours."
I felt very sorry for the poor child, and placed my hand over hers, where it rested on my arm. I presume my motive was misunderstood, for with a swift glance about the apartment to assure herself that we were alone, she threw both her arms about my neck and dragged my face down to hers.
Number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space and enjoyed it just as much the second time. Thank you so very much.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads.
But we who feel the weight of the wind.